So, is that a little loud? Is that fine? Hello? We're good? All right, so anyhow, lecture 9, I think, September 20, 2023, lecture notes, pages 81. We know that mini test 4 is up and running, has been since Tuesday, and will close this Sunday. This is a heads up that after the next mini test 5, we'll have our first midterm exam. That's worth 17% of your grade, so it's worth knowing about. It's going to open Sunday, October 1st, and close Wednesday, October 4th. So you have Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday to get it done, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., not 11:59 p.m., 6 p.m., so take notes of that. Enhanced Learning Extra Credit number, what are we on? 2, and Packback number 2, close tonight. Except for Packback. Packback didn't get opened in time, so if you're a Packback user, small number of you are, I've extended the deadline and I sent you a personal note about it. For everybody else, closes tonight. And then the next one, Enhanced Learning and Packback number 3, will open Thursday on the regular schedule, and it will run out to next Wednesday. So just a heads up, so you know what's going on, so nobody doesn't know what's going on. Webby, is you paying attention? Okay, yeah, okay. Midterm 1 opens Sunday the 1st at 8 a.m., closes Wednesday the 4th at 6 p.m. Put it in your planner so you don't forget it. It's worth 17% of your grade. What will it cover? All the material from Lecture 1 to Lecture 10, and, of course, the associated textbook material. That's the same as what's covered in Mini-Test 1 to the upcoming Mini-Test 5. It's 50 questions. It's timed for standard students to last 80 minutes. SAS students and extended time students, 160 minutes. These questions on this exam are randomly drawn from the same pool of questions that I use for the mini tests, except this exam won't have any business or marketing in these questions. It focuses on content. Sometimes I have people tell me, what do you mean it has the same test question pool as my mini tests? I took the mini tests, I didn't see a single question on the midterm from my mini test. It's a big pool, people. It's drawing questions here and there. It's not the same questions you got on your particular mini test draw. It's a big pool of questions. But I promise you, I'm not making stuff up. It's the same pool that the mini test questions draw from. The midterm exam is open book and open notes. International students, you can use the standard hard copy translation dictionary. Nobody can use anything digital on the midterm exams. Because once you get into the digital world, I can't tell what you're doing. Are you asking a friend? Are you looking stuff up online? Are you watching cat videos? I don't know what you're doing. So no digital stuff. Gee, but I have to use a digital computer to take the test. Yes, the computer you use, but nothing else. No other resource. I asked last time, or a couple times ago, some people have not used Proctorio. So Proctorio is going to record your computer camera, your microphone, and your screen. So I can review and will review to see who's doing what during the test. The starred thing is important. When you go to take your first midterm exam, reboot your computer first. Otherwise, you're going to email with problems. And the first thing I'm going to say is, did you start with a fresh reboot? And you're going to say, oh, I forgot to do that. Don't have any other programs running, don't have any other tabs opening, you're just looking for trouble with this Proctorio program. You'll need to provide a picture ID. KSU ID is preferred, but any legitimate picture ID, passport, driver's license will do. You hold it up to the screen so I can identify it's you. There is right now in the Proctorio Hub module a sample Proctorio World History quiz. Doesn't matter if you know the answers to the quiz or not. It doesn't count in your grade. The point is to see how Proctorio works. Check it on your current computer to make sure there are no issues and problems. That way, when it comes time to do the midterm, you know it's working or not working, and you can get it fixed. So that does not count as part of your class grade. It will sometimes, because you didn't reboot first, come back and say you need a code or a password. You do not. It's lying. And the first thing I'm going to tell you to do is to reboot. But if the reboot doesn't work, there's some Proctorio tips, Proctorio troubleshooting in the Proctorio help module in Canvas on our class site. So reboot, If you're having problems using Google Chrome, just switch to Microsoft Edge. That might work for you instead. There's some other ideas in the help document. Obviously, if you can't take the test, let me know, but these are the starting points. It's an open book, open notes test. You have to have physical copies of the textbook. You can't get online and look up the digital one. That's why I have the loose leaf available for you, right? And you can't use a digital copy of your lecture notes. You need to either have bought those, downloaded those, printed them out, whatever. You cannot use any other online sites during the exam. That would be cheating. You can't have notes from other sources, downloaded from the web, etc. It's supposed to be your own material. If you've typed your lecture notes online, you need to print them. You can't have mini test questions or answers with you at the exam. That would be cheating. It's an individual effort. Somebody one time said, "You didn't tell me it was an individual effort. How did I know?" It's a test! What do you mean I didn't tell you? So now you know. It's an individual effort. You can't have help. So you can't collaborate with anyone on the test. As you may recall, every time a mini test closes for a grade, it opens for review. You can go to the review folder. It's towards the bottom of that module page. You can take those review tests over and over and over and over again. They don't count in your grade. But every time it does it, it's doing a new random draw of questions from the pool of questions. Somebody said one time, "Aren't you afraid somebody could see all the questions and all the answers?" Dog, if you can memorize 1,000 questions and answers, you pretty much have the course material. I'm not worried about that. You print it out and have it in front of you, that's a problem. But if you study it enough to know it, you're good. But in a casual way, you take some of the you take some of these review test, you see what you know, you see what you don't know, you go back and look at what you don't know, you try it a couple more times. It helps out. And of course, you could see, it's possible to see, a test question that was in your review. Yay, you win. So it really does help. This is just, people say sometimes, how do you study for these tests? I don't know, you study like you do anything else. So what do? View the lectures and complete the lecture notes, handwrite them out, go back over the lecture notes, highlight the information in some way that makes sense to you. Yellow for terms, greens for examples, or whatever you do. Or use post-it notes to mark the key materials for easy reference. Read the textbook. Go back over the textbook and highlight the information in a way that makes sense for you. Then the trick is, and people sometimes miss this next step, it's a little clue I'm giving you. Study the material. I know, I know. You only hear the stuff here. Study this material in the lecture notes in the book. Too many students seem to forget to do that. Then use the review test. See what you know, see what you don't know, and you can go back and study that. As I say, the midterms draw from the same pool of questions. You may actually see some questions that are on your test. Take the review test until you know how to do them well. Go back to study what you don't know. Bring your book and your notes. Sometimes people forget to do that. It's harder to take the test that way. Don't bring many test questions or answers. That's cheating. Take the exam. If you actually did that, it should be pretty easy by the time you get to the exam. If you waited until the test day to open the book for the first time, it's not so easy. Midterm grades are coming up, and I have to post them for this course since it's a 20,000 level course. I'm going to use the first 5 mini tests plus the midterm 1 exam grade plus any extra credit. That's going to be worth about 36% of your final course grade as your midterm exam. What questions you have to me on that little rant? About the midterm, how it's going to work, where to take a sample, what you're allowed to use, what it's going to cover. Yeah.
Well, we know our answers right after we turn
out. You will. You will. You'll know your answers and your score. And again, some people are concerned, how can you do that? Because you got a random draw of 50 questions out of 1,000. I'm not too concerned you're going to share the answers with somebody else, even though I'm going to let you see them, and you'll know right away. I did not mention here, I don't think there's ever not been a curve. People don't do as well as they expect to do, or I expect them to do, on the midterms and the final. We could debate among ourselves in a class of 560 people, many of whom don't care a whit about marketing, some don't care much about business, and a few don't care much about college. What would you imagine this large class's mean would be on a big test like this? 90%? Probably not. 80%? Probably not. Really? You think 80% out of 500? 70%? Oh, it's getting a little low. So the norm, which I don't expect you all to be any different from, is 68%. That's too low. So what I do, as long as I have to curve, is I give you enough points in general to bring you up to what I think a reasonable mean would be for a large section, 72%. Somebody at the top's going to have over 100%. More than one person at the top's going to have over 100%. Somebody at the bottom after the curve is still going to have 22%. That's why the curve is low, because there's a bunch of people down there. But if you do what I said, you'll be the first class in history to not need the curve, because you're only over 72%. Yay, everyone has a 90. So that's the way it plays out. Is good? So that's my expectation. You'll be able to see it. You'll know right away your raw score, and then you'll expect, I will tell you, of course, what that curve would be. Other questions for me? Marketing in the news. So this goes on topic with stuff we've been thinking about in general as what's going on in the world around us. It also ties into understanding consumers and their behavior, how they react to things, which is important for a company. Brand boycotts, how LGBTQ plus Gen Z boomers and others respond to companies' social stances. A recent survey, and by the way, I didn't get into the details here. Anytime you read the words a recent survey or research shows, one of the things you should ask is, who ran the survey? What's their agenda? What's their background? Do they have a particular perspective? Sometimes that's insightful. So a recent survey reveals that more than half of consumers, 55%, have boycotted a brand because they disagreed with its position on a social issue, with this number rising to 80% among LGBTQ plus consumers. Have you or your friends or family ever boycotted a brand because of their social stance? Okay, maybe not 50%, but maybe 30%. So that's a little surprising, actually. It's interesting to see that there's that many folks who fit into the research. So this is an example of marketing research and understanding consumer behavior. Brands like Bud Light and Target have faced backlash from both conservative and conservative anti-LGBTQ consumers and LGBTQ plus consumers and their allies. It's hard in marketing to please everybody. You're pissing off one group or the other group. It's hard. When a brand backtracks on its support for social causes because they're getting some feedback, it often leads to consumers boycotting that brand. Approximately 1 in 5 consumers would immediately stop buying from a brand that withdrew its support for a social cause that's important to them, while 35% would continue buying from that brand but seek out a new brand that aligns better with their beliefs. So again, how would your consumers react? What are they going to do? However, brands should not shy away from taking a stance on social issues, according to the study, as abstaining from doing so can harm their reputation. Retreating from issues can then alienate both sides. Why aren't you taking a stance on this, say the conservatives? Why aren't you taking a stance on this, say the liberals? You're in a tough situation in today's world with consumers. The survey found that the impact of boycotts varies by age and LGBTQ plus status, with younger and LGBTQ plus consumers more likely to take additional actions, such as urging friends and family to stop buying from the boycotted brand. So there are differences out there in the consumer segments. Likewise, perceptions of, quote, woke brands differ significantly between LGBTQ plus and non-LGBTQ plus consumers and between Gen Z and baby boomers. Roughly a third of consumers view woke brands more positively, and that number climbs to 65% among LGBTQ plus consumers and 42% among members of Gen Z. Another third of respondents say they think less highly of so-called woke brands, with 44% of those anti-woke consumers being boomers and 37% not identifying as LGBTQ plus. So there are differences in the consumer, and it's incumbent on you to be sure you understand who you're talking to, who your audience is, what they want to hear from you, so you don't alienate them inadvertently. Or if you do something that you know isn't going to go their direction, have a plan for how you're going to respond. He said, sipping his liquid death. How many of you guys know liquid death? Have tried liquid death? No, it's not a beer. It looks a little like a tall boy, doesn't it? So this is Mountain Water. It's a strange company with obviously a strange name, Liquid Death, and they do some strange advertising. I'm going to offend somebody shortly when I show this ad, I guarantee it, because I'm a little offended. Liquid Death made a Tom Segura, do we know him? Segura. Glory hole for an innuendo-filled way to recycle. Liquid Death isn't above smutty innuendo. Why would they be? As we can see in this new campaign with comedian Tom Segura pitching his own mouth as a glory hole receptacle for recycling empty Liquid Death cans. This is smutty humor in advertising. It's using a particular spokesperson to get attention. In the faux infomercial that I'm going to show you in a minute, Segura happily pitches the 3-foot-tall box featuring his own face with an excessively wide-open mouth. Audience members ask inappropriate questions throughout. So we're getting attention. When I brought it up earlier, the site has 28,000 subscribers, and this particular episode had over 3,000 views. So it's getting attention.
Introducing the Tom Segura Recycling Glory Hole by Liquid Death, because there is nothing more glorious than saving the planet. Hey everybody, I'm Tom Segura, and I am partnering with Liquid Death to launch my very own glory hole. That's right, just walk up and slide your junk right in there.
Hey yo, you take my junk?
Unfortunately, no. Plastic isn't actually recyclable. 95% of it gets sent to landfills.
Hey, can I stick my big can in there?
Is it too big? My mouth hole takes tall boys of all sizes.
How much I gotta pay?
Just go to liquiddeath.com and make a one-time payment, and then you can use it again and again, as many times as you want.
And don't forget, Tom, women can use it too.
Good Lord, Becky, it's 2023. Everyone can recycle. My glory hole is perfect for all sorts of occasions. Pool parties, office parties, retirement parties, divorce. Whatever makes you happy and you want to celebrate, use my mouth. So what are you waiting for? Pull your cans out and stick them in my mouth hole whenever you want. We can all run train off plastic pollution together.
Get your Tom Segura Recycling Glory Hole by Liquid Death today. Available exclusively through this limited time internet offer. Order yours on liquiddeath.com/gloryhole right now.
Over 4,000 views. Oh, all of them positive. Nobody with a thumbs down on it. And it's a real thing, which means that if you go out to their site, unless they've sold out, you can actually buy the product $59. That requires some real dedication to glory holes and recycling. So, a portion of the proceeds will go towards charities that are helping to kill plastic pollution. So we're seeing socially responsible marketing in a smutty way. Yeah, that was a little too smutty. No need to do that. Didn't really find it humorous. Okay. Yeah, that was pretty funny. I was laughing at it. And I don't care one way or the other. All right, so I guess it works for most of the audience, and then there's the audience that says, yeah, that's a little, we didn't need to do that. It should have worked, but it flatlined. The product launch that haunts New Balance. Who knows New Balance? What's the image that you have of New Balance, if you describe them? I'm just curious, your image. Yeah. High quality? Yeah. Jack Harlow, should I know who that is? Who is it? Rapper singer, thank you. It's like the day I had to ask people to explain to me what twerking was. I mean, I just didn't. Thank you. I don't know. So anyhow, they're high quality. They're related with a particular reference person, right, individual. But back in 2008, New Balance was not in the position it is now. The brand was failing to cut through in the competitive world. We were finding it more challenging to connect with consumers, what we're talking about here, said Charlie Wilson, the brand's North American Director of Consumer Insights and Analytics. So we conducted some qualitative work for an upcoming shoe model. Yes, we're doing research to understand the consumer. Good job, guys, you're paying attention. That model was the X90 shoe. The bosses at the company wanted to gauge people's opinion of it through a series of focus groups across various locations like Miami and LA. The reactions were overwhelmingly positive, with many lauding the color scheme and the comfortability of the sneakers. So we're trying to measure and understand consumer attitudes, which we're talking about in the current lecture. The initial launch was successful, with strong sales and a spike in online searches, but the success was short-lived. Sales soon flatlined. Marketing in the real world is hard, people. The brand had relied heavily on the positive feedback from the focus groups and assumed it would translate into long-term success in the market, but the assumption was wrong. You got to know how to use the research you're getting, peeps. The brand realized it had created an artificial testing environment that didn't account for the complexity of the real-world consumer preferences, including factors like age, income, cultural differences. You need to understand consumers, different consumers in different market segments. The failure of the X90 launch led new brand to rethink its research and its marketing processes. They learned from their failure. The brand restructured its teams to involve various departments, including design, merchandising, and research, earlier in the product development process and for longer time periods. Remember I said marketing simplified the discovery and satisfaction to consumer needs, wants, desires at a profit, what? Through an integrated effort of the firm. It all has to pull together to make it work well. The shift in approach eventually paid off as New Balance embraced collaborations with influencers like, whoever you said, and celebrities, tapping into the crossover between sport and fashion. They focused on finding the right brand ambassadors rather than signing up as many as possible, which they had done previously. So quality over quantity, knowing what appeals to your consumers.
Due to complaints that it makes you look like a geek when you wear it alone, we've opened up the fit.
New Balance, we got now.
So Coco Gauff, pretty cool. The brand's updated strategies and partnerships helped New Balance regain its cool credentials and establish a stronger presence in the market. Today, New Balance uses focus groups more effectively and understands its place in fashion cultural landscape. It's a valuable lesson in the importance of understanding consumer behavior in the real world. Thank you, article, for talking about today's lecture for me. And adopting a long-term perspective in marketing and product development. So boom. Real world stuff, talking about what we're talking about, which is lecture notes, page 81 in chapter 5, page 140 in the textbook. So we pick up with understanding consumer behavior. We left off last time, which was here a little bit ago, but now went away. Thank you. So as I recall, we just finished up talking about Maslow's hierarchy, and we were getting into personality. Does that seem about right? Yeah? Thank you. So another one. Why do I try? So another one of these factors that we're going to talk about, understanding psychological influences on your consumer, is their personality. Personality is a person's pattern of traits that influence their behaviors. I don't know, do you know anybody in your personal life that tends to be outgoing, friendly, effusive? Oh, darling, how are you? Kiss, kiss. You know people like that? If they're like that in their life and across a lot of social situations, I bet they dress in an outgoing way. They probably aren't meek and shy in how they dress. Do you know people that the other way in your life, they're sort of depressed, repressed, suppressed people? Probably they buy products that reflect that as well. So your personality affects most of your daily situation. So we say if a person is confident or dependent or fearful or sexual, personality traits, in their everyday life, we imagine these same traits will likely influence them in their style of consumer decision making. So what kinds of consumers do you tend to have? There was a company that was marketing, I think on the West Coast, but it doesn't matter, an analgesic, a pain relief product. And they found over time by studying their heavy users that their consumers tended to be sort of compulsive. Do you ever have a friend that comes into your space, into your place, and they're straightening up your magazines or they're straightening up the pencils on your desk? You know the sort of person I'm talking about? What are you doing? Leave it alone. But they have a compulsive type of personality. Compulsive personalities like things orderly, and they also respect the opinions of officials like, say, physicians. So this particular analgesic changed its ads. They moved it to an orderly fashion. When you have pain, take these three steps. 1, 2, 3, orderly. And here's what your doctor recommends. It worked very well for their group of semi-compulsive personality types. So what's your personality type for your product? Yeah? Perception. Perception is the process of receiving, organizing, and giving meaning to stimuli detected by one of our five senses. Here's one of the hard questions for the day. I know you're going to be deep in thought. What are the five senses that contribute to perception? Touch, taste. What is it? Hearing, eh? What? Touch, taste, smell. I forget what I missed there. Sights, I know. Well, you know the five. These are the things that put you in touch with the real world. But we don't all understand the real world the same way. We perceive things differently. It sounds simple to say, but sometimes marketers don't seem to understand it. Here's my message. You got it. You got it. We're done. No, people perceive it differently. Why? Well, in part due to what's called selective perception. We don't all pay attention to the same cues in the same way. Some of us skip over words or ideas or designs or whatever. Did you get to the fifth one? You're still finding it. So it's touch, taste, sight, sound, and smell. There's five of them. She was still counting them here on four. Selective exposure. We choose not to expose ourselves to all possible stimuli, including, of course, marketing stimuli. I don't want to hear about that. Or channels. I don't listen to hip-hop, so I don't know what she said. I just don't know them because I don't listen to that source. Well, if that's what I'm advertising or not, it's not going to work. Due to selective comprehension, we, for a variety of reasons, choose to understand things in particular ways. Could be based on our experiences, could be based on our age, our gender. There's a lot of things that could cause us to comprehend things differently. Selective retention. We don't remember everything equally the same. Different people remember different things. And this used to be a hot topic. I leave it in because it's vaguely interesting, but nobody seems to really care about subliminal perception anymore, but I feel obligated to check on it. So, overall, selective perception is the process that we use to determine what to perceive, in quotes. Who works in a grocery store? Grocery store? Do you have any idea how many little items there are in a grocery store? 10 or 20 physical items? Are there more than that? 100? Thousands. 10,000? 20,000? Let's ask ourselves the following question. What if you could not selectively perceive the world and you went grocery shopping? So you'd walk up to the first object you saw. Do I want this object? It's a can of soup. What kind of soup? Tomato soup. Do I want tomato soup? No, I don't. What's this next object on the shelf? What could it likely be? It's another can. What could it be a can of? Tomato soup. Do I want that one? No. How long would it take you to do your weekly shopping? 2 years? It doesn't work that way, thank goodness. You scan stuff, you selectively perceive things that you're looking for, and you skip over denture cream because you don't need any. So, thank goodness. So due to this selective process, we often, as human beings and consumers, we often omit stuff, we often add stuff, and we even change what we see, what we feel, what we hear, what we smell, what we taste, what we touch, fiber. Selective perception, though, doesn't happen all at once. It occurs in various stages, including selective exposure, which I mentioned, selective comprehension, selective retention. And marketers have to be well aware of this. Ha! So let's take a look at differences in men versus women and the way they perceive the world. When I first did this, it was original, new, and nobody else had seen it. If you've already seen this, please don't yell out the answer. It spoils it for the rest of the men and women in the class. Shh! Keep it to yourself. But we look and see about how selective perception works. See if we see some differences between men and women. Let's see how this plays out for us. You have to pay a little attention to my perceptual exercise. Here we go. If you know it, don't yell it out.
This is an awareness test. How many passes does the team in white make?
Go!
The answer.
Oh, no, 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 no. Rats, I was looking at the dock. All right. Did you hear the answer? All right. How many guys who didn't know what was going on got the answer right? How many didn't get it right? How many gals, women, I shouldn't say gals, I'll be in court. How many women got the answer right? How many didn't get the answer right? Okay. So, in fact, as you may have just seen, about the same number of men and women got it right and wrong, okay? How many of you know where I'm going with this because you've already seen this elsewhere? How many are still puzzled by where I'm headed? All right, so let's see what's up next. And I'm sorry that I didn't catch it before it came on, but let's pick up here.
The answer is 13. But did you see the moonwalking bear?
Okay, hold on. Who did not see the moonwalking bear? Are you sure you didn't see the moonwalking bear? It was right there. Here it comes. I'm going to show you. It's not a trick. I'm going to show you the moonwalking bear. Now, interestingly, some people still won't see the moonwalking bear. But here we go. We're rewinding. Same thing. No difference. How many folks now see the moonwalking bear? Who still doesn't see the moonwalking bear? Are you raising? I can see you talking. Did you not see the moonwalking bear this time either? She's not going to look at me. Look me in the eye. All right, let me get to the point of this ad and then to the point of the exercise. It's easy to see something you're not looking for. Look out for cyclists. And so they took this example, which has been used elsewhere, and they made it work in terms of, hey, it's easy not to see what you're not looking for. Why would you say people didn't see the moonwalking bear? Why? It was there. Why didn't they see it? I forced you through my magical talents as a marketer to focus on a particular thing. Which marketers do sometimes in their communication, focus on something. And when you're focused on the one thing, most of us, not all of us, can't see the other thing. Attention is selective. You can't, because of psychological barriers, see everything all at once and process it all at once. You focus your attention selectively on things that are important to you, that marketers point your attention to. So as a cyclist, you want to be careful that if you're riding out on the road, you want to be careful that you don't run over a cyclist that you aren't expecting. Is this where it should be? It's not. How many of you guys have seen these perceptual exercises before? How many of you guys have seen the black and blue versus white and gold? Okay, so let me ask a question, and I'm always stunned because I know what the answer is. How many of you guys see that as being blue and black? Look around the room for a second. Because I know the right answer. How many of you see that as white and gold? And it's clear as day, am I right? These other guys are goofing on you. They're not really seeing the other color, are they? They are. How's that possible? It's clearly white and gold. People perceive stimuli in different ways. Would it be important to you as a marketer if it was important to know that it was white and gold? Would it be important to know some people aren't seeing it that way? You bet it would. Yeah? Which one are you seeing? No, you are not. This one, also, I did not think would play. Well, the first time I did this one, I thought my wife was kidding me. I thought she was messing with me. I also did not know if it would work in the classroom. Yeah, that's a science thing. Let's see if I can get it to work here. See what you hear.
Yeah.
It's very clear.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I got it.
Yeah.
All right. So the right answer is? I understand you people. It's clearly Laurel. Yanny hearers, listeners, Laurel hearers, okay? There is a scientific explanation for what you hear based on your hearing, how acute it is, whether you're tuned to higher or lower. But looking around the room, half of you are hearing one and half of you are hearing the other. What if you were a marketer and had no clue about perception? You'd have no clue that your ad isn't working the way you expect it to work. How can you be kidding me? What did you hear? You're just messing with me. You people are just messing with me. So, it's fairly important to understand perception affects the human condition as a marketer. Selective exposure. From the variety of communications available to them, people choose to expose themselves, oddly phrased, expose themselves to only some of the communications. So it's really important for you to know that consumers tend to view communication like advertisements that reaffirm their pre-existing ideas and attitudes. And we certainly know this in the world of politics, do we not? We know that conservative people tend to listen to conservative views and blow off, or not even listen to, liberal views. And liberal people live in their liberal bubble. They tend to hear liberal things and block out, not even pay attention to conservative views. Not good for politics. So they tend to listen to things that reaffirm their pre-existing ideas or attitudes, and thereby bolstering their image of what they know of themselves, who they are. Politics, consumers as well. Are you a fashionista? Are you a intellectual? Are you a sports dude or dudette? Who are you? Those are the things we tend to pay attention to that reinforce us. So marketers, knowing this, have to find some way to break through those barriers, get people to pay attention as appropriate. These are just some examples of marketers breaking through barriers to perception. Even if you weren't a nail biter, would someone carrying that bag down the street get your attention? Well, it might. You might go, what is it? Whoa, nail biter. Never heard of that, but okay. In addition, for example, people rarely read web pages word by word. Instead, they scan the page, picking out individual words and sentences. So they selectively expose themselves to your web page, to your information, to your content. In research on how people read websites, it was found that 79% of their test users always scanned any new page they came across. Only 16% read it word by word. I'm stunned that 16% of consumers read a web page word by word, but that's what the research showed. But anyhow, you're a marketer. You're trying to get this concept out so people understand the new product, the benefit, the feature, the comparison to competition, and they're just scanning through it. You better know that and know how to hit the high points for them. Selective comprehension. This is knowing that people interpret different information out there such that it's consistent with their beliefs and attitudes. So assuming they do pay attention to it, they don't comprehend it the same way. It was once reported in a study that 80% of non-smokers believe there's a link between smoking and lung cancer. How many of you guys know someone in your life, someone in your family, some friend that, or maybe you, poo-poos this idea that smoking is actually related to lung cancer? My uncle smoked 5 packs a day and he lived to 108. How many know people that still refute that? They don't believe it. Yeah, okay. I don't know if they're smokers or not, it's not important. Yet only 52% of heavy smokers accept the link. Almost half don't believe it's true. They selectively comprehend the world around them. All right, so now, I'm telling you, I'm gonna fool ya. I'm gonna show you stuff and you're gonna misperceive it. I'm giving you fair warning, it's gonna happen. Now, since I'm warning you about it, how many think he's not gonna fool me? I'm good, not gonna, okay, one. Wow, I got the rest of you guys, hornswoggled here. All right, I'm gonna show you briefly three sayings that I think should be well known, okay? And I'm gonna give you a chance to look at those three sayings, and then I'm gonna ask you in a minute, no surprises here, I'm gonna ask you to tell me what the sayings are, so you know what the test is. Here's gonna be three sayings, you're gonna have time to look at them, and then you're gonna tell me what they are. Ready? Here we go, I'm gonna fool a bunch of yous. All right, so there's 1, 2, 3. Okay. Who isn't sure what I just did and don't know why I'm asking the question? Okay. Okay, so what did you see? Give me one of the sayings. Oh, I'm sorry, I cut you. All right, did you see one? Paris in the Spring. How many people saw Paris in the Spring? Yeah, that's right. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe I didn't fool. What was another saying?
Once in a lifetime.
Once in a lifetime. How many people saw Once in a Lifetime? Did anybody not see Once in a Lifetime? I'll come back to you in a second. Is that because you know what was going on, or you got what was going on? You got what was going on. I'm coming to you in a second. What was the third one? Anybody remember the third one at this point? Yeah. A Bird in the Hand. How many people saw A Bird in the Hand? How many people didn't see A Bird in the Hand? Oh, interesting. All right, now I'm going to slow it up a bit, because obviously I'm doing something here you're not getting that he got. So I'm going to leave it up for a little bit more. Don't yell to your neighbor what you're now seeing. Don't yell. And by the way, I fooled a whole bunch of you. I'm telling you that. So here we go. Look at it. Thank you. Careful, watch your cord. Okay. Who now sees what I've done? Sees how I fooled you? Who still hasn't seen what's going on yet? Come on, come on. Be honest. I expect you not to, some of you not to see it. And some people aren't playing. Oh my, oh my. What's going on?
The middle one is once in a lifetime.
Oh, the middle one is once in a lifetime. So you caught that. We got another. How many people caught that? You still don't see it, or you see it now? How many people know there was more going on? How many people still don't know there's more going on? Okay. So I want you to read with me, because we're going to be real specific here. Read that first one to me, please, just so I know. Okay, and how about the last one? Oh, God golly, Paris in the spring, once in a lifetime, bird in the hand. How many guys did I fool on the first time around? And I told you I was going to do it. And a bunch of you said I wasn't going to do it. Now, what's the importance of this? Suppose you're a marketer getting a message out, and suppose you found, this would be a silly example, but it was really important that your consumers knew it said da-da, a-a, or da-da. Give me a solution for the problem. How could I make sure my consumers were aware of this particular stimuli? One idea. Yo. I could change the font color. I could put one in yellow and one in green, unless you're colorblind. I don't know how that works. But yeah, what else could you do? You perhaps could put them on both lines and change their font color, or bold one, or underline one. There's a bunch of things you could do, but in order to do those things, what would you have to be aware of? Consumers don't necessarily perceive things exactly the way you put them up there. They selectively perceive things. They don't get the exposure just the way your ad says it. And if it's important to you, you got to understand that. Do a little research. Find out what they're seeing. All right. So here's a number example. Again, if you've already seen it, don't mess with me. But how many people see the problem in the number example? How many people don't see the number in the problem example? Don't see it? Okay. Somebody who saw it, yell out what the problem is. First line, see, I misdirected you with the numbers on purpose. A bunch of us didn't get it because I knew you wouldn't. I pointed you to the numbers, but it says, can you find the mistake? Selective retention. People don't always remember what they've come in contact with. Even when they perceive it and understand it, they may not remember it. People tend to remember things more accurately that are favorable to their self-image than things that are unfavorable. So when you tell people they're not doing the right thing, they're bad, don't do this thing, they likely don't remember the message. So people tend to remember the good things and forget the bad. How many of you know a friend, or maybe yourself, that was dating somebody who had a lot of bad qualities, and you or they didn't see the bad qualities? They selectively perceived what was going on. You could see what was going on. Can't you see this guy's a jerk? No, he's a... What are you talking about? So the same thing happens in products, right? Selective retention reinforces people's self-image. Marketers need to find ways to help consumers retain, get and retain their message. So you go into that grocery store and you see on the end cap a big display that mimics our ad, our website, our video for Oral-B to remind people, hey, you thought that was interesting, go check it out. There's the connection. Oh yeah, helps me remember it. Subliminal perception used to be a thing. Anybody know what subliminal perception is in marketing? Anybody know what subliminal perception is? No idea. Well, it's really falling out of favor. So this was an idea from a while ago that marketers could influence you to buy products by subtly and quietly putting words on into the video. Buy my product, buy my product, buy my. Or blinking on the screen, something like that. It came from an old, well-disproven urban myth that supposedly, one time one theater got in cahoots with some companies and they blinked on the screen very quickly, faster than you could see. Drink Coke, buy popcorn, supposedly. But too fast for you really process. But supposedly Coke and popcorn sales went up. It was all baloney. It was never proven to be true because it wasn't true. And yet people got in mind marketers were doing this with their advertising. Subliminal means it's below your ability to perceive overtly the visual thing, the aural thing. How would that work in the real world? I can barely hear me. Now you're going to create an ad that's so quiet that I can't hear it, but somebody's going to hear, you're going to hear it? I don't know, what would it mean? So subliminal perception, not really a thing. It's taken on another life that your book talks about. They call it subliminal perception. It's not. At best, you can refer to it as hidden stimuli. Hidden stimuli. They aren't subliminal. They are not beneath your ability to perceive them. Subliminal? No. On the other hand, they're a bit hidden. So in this one, can anybody see what's hidden? The hidden stimuli? Can you see the hidden stimuli? It's supposed, I guess, maybe to get you to buy it. I don't know. All right. Oh, you can see it. You got it. What is it? Yeah, but what? Oh, well, that's right. So that's what I'm saying. It's not subliminal. It's at best hidden. All right, I'm going to show it to you. All right, here it comes. Do you see it now? How many people see it now? How many people still don't see it? Anybody doesn't see it? All right, you don't see it yet? The yellow sex is popping up there, all right? Yellow sex, I don't know if that's a thing or not. Now, I made it go away, okay? How many people can't see the message anymore? It's gone from your perception. Can anybody not see it now? How's that subliminal? Hidden, yes, but once you see it, it's there. It's not subliminal. There's another hidden message here. Does anybody see the other message that's here? Watch this one. Here it comes. Boom. Oh my goodness, look at that. Wait a second. Oh, it's gone. I don't know where it went. I can't see it anymore. Yeah, I can, right? So at best, it's not subliminal. At best, it's hidden. So these people make a whole big deal about this sort of thing. No advertiser ever used subliminal advertising for audio or video. That's not to say some doofus somewhere didn't do something goofy, but it's not an ad practice. Yeah. FedEx Arrow is, I know exactly what you're saying. It's something that once you see it, you can't unsee it, but it's not meant to be hidden per se, but they don't make a big deal about it, except they release information on it periodically. So if you look at, oh yeah, so one day we'll actually see that. I didn't have it up here today, but it's that sort of thing, I guess, yeah. So I'm not too sure that having the word sex there sells more of the book, and I don't know if having that lady there sells more of the book, but it's an example of what popular press people get books published on. So not subliminal. So, where are we? Consumers perceive marketing stimuli selectively because each individual is unique in their combination of their needs, wants, desires, attitudes, experiences, personal characteristics. And so, why I'm rambling on about this, identical advertisements, identical packages, the same products may be perceived very differently by different consumers. It's incumbent on you to know that as a business person, as a marketer. And how do your consumers perceive it? Maybe you don't care how others perceive it. How do your consumers perceive it? Research into it. Perceived risk. Perceived risk is another psychological influence on consumer decision making. It represents the consumer's, well, perceptions of riskiness of the purchase itself. It comes in different flavors. Financial risk. It's obvious to state, I assume, that people will make different kinds of evaluations, different kinds of searches, use different kinds of criteria for things that are very costly versus things that are not a financial risk. What's the worst case if you go to a vending machine and get a candy bar you don't like? You buy another one. What's the worst case if you go to the car dealer and buy a car you don't like? You're in for some hassle, and maybe you own a car you don't like. So I'd rather be a little more cautious on the car buying side. Physical risk. Again, I don't remember. Do we have any extreme sports people, ex-sports people here do anything extreme? Where's my skateboarder? So I don't know, do you take any interest in the particular brand you buy and its wheels and its truck, or you just buy whatever's on the shelf, the cheap one? Try to pick good ones. Why? Well, if the wheel breaks, perish the thought, I'm hurting. So the physical risk is something that causes me to shop differently than I'm buying, well, again, a candy bar, not a magazine. There's not that much risk there. Performance risk, what happens if that skydiving parachute doesn't open? There's significant issues there. The risk of failure is significant. Psychosocial risk. What would your friends and family say if, fill in the blank, you got a tattoo, you wore a mohawk, you bought that particularly unusual outfit? I tell you a true story for a long time, not so much recently. My wife wanted me to get a pierced ear and pop in an earring. I said to her, darling, I'm sure you would find that sexy. But how do you think I'm going to be perceived by my faculty in the College of Business Department of Marketing? I'm not getting my ear pierced, even though it would make you happy. There's too much psychosocial risk. Oh, that's a nice look. So do you ever either make a decision or not make a decision as you think about how would people judge you? I'm sorry, I gave into what I perceived to be peer pressure. I wasn't doing it. Marketers have to understand their consumers' perceptions of risk and address them as appropriate. What would you do to reduce the financial risk, the physical risk, the performance risk, or the psychosocial risk, given your target audience and what you believe their reactions based on research would be? This is chemistry.com from a while ago. Obviously, the dating scene has changed over time. Reducing the financial risk for this then somewhat new product.
I vow to never wear a flannel nightgown.
Can you just make that, I vow to never wear a nightgown? I vow to never be a classic rock DJ.
I promise to embrace your human beatbox. Isn't it time you found great chemistry with someone? At chemistry.com, we vow to help you find it. Take our personality test and get your first 5 chemistry-inspired matches free. Visit chemistry.com today.
So when I put it together, this was 1 month for $40, 3 months for $80. It's different today, but that's not the point. The point is, in the day, they said, hey, let's reduce that financial risk. Let's give away the first free matches. Learning is an important factor in human behavior and consumer behavior. Learning involves changes in behavior resulting from, well, observation, experience that we need to know about. Classical conditioning is one theory of human and consumer learning. Who comes to mind when I talk about classical conditioning? Pavlov and his dogs. And our dog is gone, so maybe to talk about dogs, otherwise, you know, the dog gets upset when I talk about dogs. So what's the basic idea about Pavlov's dogs? It's the idea that we learn by connecting stimuli with either pleasure or pain. So what does Pavlov do in his original classic experience? He notices that when dogs see food, they salivate. They begin to drip and they're ready to eat. So he has an idea. He takes a dog, probably a hungry dog, gives the dog a little food, a little spray of meat powder, and as he does that, he rings a bell. So he pairs the two things. The food is what's called an unconditioned stimulus. It's a thing that you react to naturally. The salivation, I'm sounding religious there, what word do I want? Anyhow, the dripping of the mouth of saliva is the unconditioned response. So we don't have to train you to get all mouthwatery when you see the food. The bell is what's called the conditioned stimulus. What meaning does the bell have to the dog originally? Ding. Cut it with the dog, that's what, okay? I pair the conditioned stimulus, the bell, with the unconditioned stimulus, the food, over and over and over again. And pretty soon, what does Pavlov find? He rings the bell without giving the dog any food, and what happens automatically? The dog salivates, okay? So here, we have taken a meaningless stimuli, the bell, and paired it with something meaningful such that the animal responds automatically. The dog doesn't sit there and think, good golly gosh, what happened the last time I got the bell? It's an automatic response. What's this have to do with human behavior? Well, I don't know. You're walking down the street one day, minding your own business, and all of a sudden a dog rushes out from behind a bush, barks, woof, and grievously. That's how dogs bark. And grievously inflicts pain upon your calf. You have to go to the doctor. You have to get shots. You're walking down the street after all this happens and you hear a dog bark. What do you stop and think? Oh, man, last time a dog barked at me, it rushed out and bit me. I probably ought to get out of here. Is that what happens? What do you suppose happens? Boom, instantaneously, you've paired the previously innocuous, presumably, dog bark with pain. Boom, you've connected the two. Happens in human behavior, happens in consumer behavior, happens in animal behavior as well. So if you have a situation where you take a meaningless stimuli, a brand name that has not yet gotten out there, Victoria's Secret, and you pair it with a meaningful stimuli, sexy women in lingerie, and you get a response out of men and women in the day. Again, we've moved beyond such smutty matters. What happens over time? Over time, when you see Victoria's Secret, you get this feeling of angels and wings and sexiness, yeah? Happens automatically. We don't stop and think about it. Marketers do this all the time. They take a meaningless stimuli, whether it's an image, whether it's a name, pair it up with something that does have meaning, and over time, when you see that thing, boom. You get that reaction, you get that response. The humorous take on this, bell rings, I get a treat. Bell rings, I get a treat. It went on that way for days. Then out of the blue, the bell rings and I get nothing, nada. I mean, can you seriously call my attack unprovoked? The dark truth about Pavlov's dog. So one approach to learning, thinking about learning and how consumers change their behavior based on their experience is what we do to pair brand names, brand images, brand objects with something that's meaningful until eventually the name creates the feeling automatically in the consumer. A bad example from a long time ago, other than Victoria's Secret, was the Marlboro Man. In American society, cowboys are masculine, macho. They give you that feeling. Marlboro had no particular meaning to consumers initially. In fact, amusingly, Marlboro was originally a woman's cigarette. They changed the branding. Marlboro Cowboy. Pretty soon you see Marlboro, you feel the machismo. The manly stuff. operant conditioning. Anybody know from psychology who we connect this with or what kind of animal we connect it with? Yeah. Ooh, you went a different direction for me. I was going to go with Skinner and his rats, but Thorndike was probably his partner in crime. So in this case, we find that people, animals, will start with learn by trial and error, operating on their world and finding things that happen that work for them through trial and error. So we operate on our environment in a trial and error fashion. And if we get a reward, we learn that that's a reward for us. It's a good thing because we operate in trial and error. So you take a rat, hungry rat, all our animals are hungry. We drop them in a maze. Rats are curious creatures and they're hungry. So they start running around the maze. And eventually they see a bar. Not that kind of bar, that kind of bar. And eventually they tap the bar. What happens? They get a food pellet. Whoa, they're a happy rat. You drop them in the maze a second time, they may wander a little bit, but man, as soon as they see that bar, boom, they're going for it. They know through trial and error, that bar is good for them. The third time, man, they aren't wandering. Zip, 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 they hit the bar, they're getting their reward. So, you're in that grocery store shopping, and you come up on an end cap display for kumquat flavored ding-dongs. You must be really hungry because you pick up some kumquat flavored ding-dongs, you take them home. Your family loves them. Oh my, where'd you get these? What are these? These are fantastic. What happens the next time you go to the grocery store, do you imagine? I bet you're getting some more kumquat flavored ding-dongs. And you bring them home again, and people are still enthused by them. You're going to be a regular purchaser of these things. Why? Because through operant conditioning, you operate in a trial and error fashion. Let me try these. You learn something from that, and you become now a user of this fantastic, new-to-you product. So we'll press lever for food. We'll buy kumquat-flavored ding-dongs for reward for my social circle, for my friends, for my family. And I like them, too. I couldn't actually find any kumquat-flavored ding-dongs, but you'll notice the connection because that is Hostess, and Smucker's is about to buy Hostess. Now, how is that for connecting things? Social learning. We know that people also learn from other people. So you learn, well, actually, research shows that from a very young age, in general, you can find exceptions, infants learn very quickly to identify the behavior of women around them. Infant boys learn very quickly to identify the behavior of males around them. And that starts at a very early age, on average. So we learn by observing the behavior of those around us, social learning, what are they doing? That's how I'll act. And whether or not it's gender specific, how do you act as a nice person in the world from your family and friends? Yeah. So we know that people learn from observing others. This is an example from the family circus. Here's Jeffy talking to PJ. PJ, stop it. Stop copying me. A social behavior that he's observing. But of course, what's he doing? He's sitting on the couch imitating dad. So here's social learning occurring down through the generations, if you will. Here's a very old example demonstrating to consumers through a public service announcement. Your kids learn from how you behave.
Like father, like son. Think about it. For information on smoking and heart disease, ask your heart association.
Think about it. You're mimicking, or your child is going to mimic the behavior that you engage in through social learning. Is that really the lesson you're going to talk about? It was a, obviously, anti-smoking campaign, which is a form of marketing, certainly. So we know that consumers learn from each other. I thought I had another example here. There's an example of someone, and maybe we're going to see it later in the series. But anyhow, there's an example of Kellogg's, I think it's Rice Krispies. And mom is thinking back to the days when her mom poured Rice Krispies for her. Oh, snap, crackle, pop. And now we see her pouring it for her kids. Oh, listen, snap, crackle, pop. Social learning through the generations passed down to your children. Cognitive learning. Another way that people learn is thinking about stuff. Rational, logical approach to the world. Thank goodness for that. So if we're selling you some technical device or something with a lot of complexity to it, probably classical conditioning isn't the way to go. So I'm probably going to have to use a very nice, logical, rational explanation of what it is you're getting, what its value is, what its benefit is, how it compares to the competition or to what you already have. And through that logical process of building up arguments, people will cognitively learn to prefer your brand over other brands, yeah? So these are the various ways that we think about consumers learning. The point about learning, very important to us in marketing, is one thing consumers can learn is brand loyalty, yay. Consumers can learn to prefer your brand, regardless of what method of learning occurs, over all the other brands. And that's really important to us in marketing. So how are you going to teach your consumers to prefer your product over all others? What form of learning makes the most sense in your situation? A key summary in people's minds of all of this is their beliefs and their attitudes. Based on what they've learned from processing information, evaluating alternatives, previously making choices, and evaluating the choice, consumers form beliefs about the stores, the products, the brands, their decision process. Maybe I should not have just rushed out and bought a car. Maybe I should have looked around a little bit. That actually happened to me. My first car, I just had some money that I'd earned. I rushed out. I bought a car. It was an American Motors, no longer around. Javelin. Javelin was a pretty sexy car. It's a terrible car. Bad car. I didn't do that again. So anyhow, what was I talking about? What's the belief about your decision process? And they will then, based on those beliefs, presumably, form attitudes, either favorable attitudes or unfavorable attitudes about these things. In general, we say consumers seldom buy things that they have no attitude about. How do you have no attitude about something? Maybe you're unaware of it, and then you don't buy it because you don't know about it. When attitudes are positive, of course, they influence the consumer's next choice. Again, not the most difficult question you're going to hear this semester, but if consumers have positive attitudes about your brand, what do you suppose that's going to do on their next purchase for them? What are they going to do? Nobody has a clue. Was the question too complex? You can say it, thank you. Buy it again. Yay, that's what we want. Of course, the flip is true too. When attitudes don't exist, it's a new brand, an unknown brand. How many people don't know the car Maybach? Don't know Maybach. Okay, was it you down here mentioned Maybach? No, somebody was sitting here mentioned Maybach as a car. Whole bunch of people don't know Maybach. They aren't going to buy Maybach for another reason. Of course, it runs $1 million. But they've never even heard of the brand. How are they going to buy it? Or negative, they also influence the consumer's choice. And of course, the negative issue is the one that's more important at the moment. They formed a negative belief, a negative attitude about your brand. They're not coming back to it, or your store, or the purchase decision they made. And you have to be aware of what's causing that. Marketers attempt to change these unfavorable attitudes using one of the four P's of the marketing mix. But I have a nice little story I tell about this part. And I only have a few minutes left. And I've been talking an awful lot, as most students here would agree. So I think this is where we'll break today's lecture. So what's still coming? A new pack back enhanced learning and a test. Closing Sunday. We'll see you guys later. Have a good few days. Thanks for bearing with me. Happy perception to you and yours.